Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest and partner, Dave Zangrilli. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Dave's calling in today. He is a principal in our firm's Family Law and Domestic Relations Practice Group and represents clients in courts throughout Virginia, including Northern Virginia counties of Arlington, Fairfax, Loudoun, Prince William, the city of Alexandria, and you name it, all over the place. And he's been a family law attorney for almost 10 years. He's been on the show before, and he's talked to us about a variety of different issues, including prenuptial agreements. Today, Dave, what are we talking about? What's our topic du jour?
Wayne, today we're going to talk about taxes and how taxes need to be considered when folks are getting a divorce and when they're drafting their property settlement agreements.
It's near and dear to my heart. I love taxes. And what's the first bit of advice that you always give to your clients when you're talking to them?
Yeah, the first bit of advice we always give and that I always give is to make sure you consult with either a CPA or a tax lawyer like yourself, because most divorce attorneys are not CPAs. And although we certainly, you know, the good ones know enough about taxes, and we've learned a lot about taxes over the years, we're not CPAs. And to make clients feel really safe and secure, we always advise them to speak with either a CPA or a tax lawyer.
That's true. And I think you start with probably one of the most important points that everyone needs to know about, and that is about alimony. Tell us about alimony.
Yeah, that's probably the most well-known issue in terms of taxes in a divorce. When a payor, oftentimes, but not always, oftentimes the husband historically pays alimony that is deductible to the payor on his or her taxes, and the recipient of the alimony has to include that income, that alimony, as income on their taxes.
You know, that's an interesting concept. Every month there may be an alimony payment, right?
Correct.
And so one of the things that people forget about is that when they are receiving these alimony payments, that they not only have to report it on their income tax, but it also is subject to estimated tax, is it not?
That's correct. They're supposed to really pay those quarterly, although
That's right. That's
if I
correct.
Had a dollar for every time one of my clients has done that, I'd probably have $1.
Oh.
Because most people just don't do that. And it can be a shock to the system when that individual goes to file his or her taxes at the end of the year, and then all of a sudden I have to include all that alimony as income that they haven't paid taxes on. So when they may have thought they were going to receive a refund, now all of a sudden they have a tax liability to the IRS.
Now, what's so unique about alimony? I know that there are specific rules under the Internal Revenue Code in order for it to be treated as alimony.
Yeah, the biggest rule, really, and there's a few of them, but probably the most important is that it has to be, the alimony has to be paid pursuant to either a court order or a written agreement, a contract, you know, a property settlement agreement. If you just pay voluntarily, you know, if you have a handshake deal with your spouse that I'll start paying you alimony, and you pay a bunch of money each month for a period of time, and then you go to deduct that on your taxes as the payor, the IRS isn't going to let you do that. You have to actually have a provision in a court order or an agreement saying that this is alimony and this will be tax deductible to me, the payor, and tax includable, you know, to the recipient.
So what about child support? Is it treated the same or differently?
Child support is not treated the same. It's different. Child support is not taxable.
And when you're negotiating a settlement, I mean, what are some of the important things that people are looking at when they're negotiating the settlement here?
Yeah, one of the biggest issues that I think most people, at least coming into the process, haven't thought about is the tax effect of the spousal support, of the alimony. Because oftentimes, you know, in these divorce cases here in Virginia, most clients, most lawyers, we all use the same sheets. We have these clients fill out what we call income and expense statements, which are really just a monthly budget.
Right.
And at the bottom, you know, it's an Excel spreadsheet, and it tells you, here's how much money I need each month to pay all of my bills. So, you know, let's say it says $5,000. So the client says, I need at least $5,000 in spousal support.
Right.
Well, the part they don't consider is they're going to have to pay taxes on that at the end of the year. So really, you know, depending on which tax bracket they're in, they may need $5,500 or $6,000 in support to actually meet their monthly expenses.
Okay.
And it's the same thing for the payor. It can actually be a benefit. You know, oftentimes the payor will get angry when they see the large number that their spouse is requesting. You know, I can't believe that she wants me to pay $8,000 a month in spousal support. Well, what they don't think about is the net effect, that really they're paying, you know, $6,500 or whatever the figure is based upon their particular tax bracket.
That's right. And I think that's a really important thing to remind people of. If you're going to treat it as alimony, it's taxable, unlike when you're married, you know, payments to a spouse are non-deductible and not taxed as income.
That's exactly right.
Now, let's talk about retirement plans. What's so unique about retirement plans, IRAs, pensions, profit sharing plans?
Yeah, IRAs and retirements and all defined contribution plans it's not a taxable event when such a retirement plan is divided during a divorce process.
Okay.
So if husband has a 401k with $100,000 in it and the parties agree that wife will get, you know, half of that, it's a non-taxable event pursuant to a divorce. What happens is essentially the money goes over to the wife and she has her own individual 401k account. And then, of course, the only time it would be taxable is if, you know, either spouse takes an actual distribution out of that retirement account.
Right. And then it becomes taxable as ordinary income. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues in terms of the tax rate as compared to other types of income.
Right.
I know that there's something called a quadro that people refer to in these environments. So tell us a little bit about that real quick.
Sure. A quadro is it's an abbreviation, QDRO, which stands for Qualified Domestic Relations Order. Under the federal code, you know, it's governed by ERISA. A lot of these plans are governed by the federal statute ERISA. And when you divide up a 401k or 403bs or similar retirement vehicles, you need to have the quadro. It's just a court order entered by the court, which divides up the retirement. And these can kind of be a pain in the neck for lawyers to draft, and it can be quite a process. When you deal with IRAs, those are not generally subject to ERISA, so you don't need to get into that hassle of drafting a quadro. It's much easier to divide. But oftentimes people are really angered over how long it takes to have a quadro entered by the court and sent to the plan administrator to actually have the 401ks divided up between the spouses.
That's interesting. So a very important point to note that Dave just brought up, a qualified domestic relations order is required for ERISA-covered plans like profit-sharing plans, 401ks. But it's not required for individual retirement account splitting, even though the splitting is not going to be taxed.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Good. But now, we talked about splitting, you know, retirement plans. What about all other assets?
The nice thing about divorce, maybe one of the only, you know, positive things about the divorce process is that whenever assets are divided, it's a non-taxable event. The simple fact of the divorce and the splitting up of assets does not trigger any taxes. So if you receive stock, for example, from your spouse, you know, you have the same tax basis as he or she did. You know, and so the parties don't pay taxes on any assets they receive pursuant to a divorce agreement, I should say.
I wonder if the ease with which the Internal Revenue Code allows for a divorce to occur has influenced the rate of divorce over the years. I just sort of thought of that.
I'm just guessing that that's probably not one of the primary factors.
One of the intended consequences of these provisions.
Right.
So what happens at the end of the year when it's time to file taxes? Let's say the divorce went through, you know, on October the 31st and it was finalized. How do you file taxes then?
Yeah, good question. The way the IRS works it is that your tax status, whether you file married, head of household, married, filing separately, what have you, is determined as of December 31 of that taxable year. So, for example, let's talk about 2012. If spouses are divorced in 2012, mm-hmm. they have to file a single because that's what their tax status is.
Okay.
The bigger issue more often is that, you know, the parties have separated and maybe they even have a property settlement agreement in place, but, you know, January 1 rolls around and they're still married. The question is, how are they going to file taxes? And the best practice is certainly to have that issue negotiated and resolved in the property settlement agreement so that each party knows, you know, if alimony was paid, how is it going to be claimed? Who's going to claim the child? You know, if there's deductions relating to your house, the mortgage interest deduction and the real estate tax deduction, who are going to claim those? So, you know, a good piece of advice is to make sure you negotiate that and have it included in the property settlement agreement.
That is a good piece of advice. Thanks for that. Now, what about, you know, on the tax returns, we all try to claim our children as dependents to the extent that we have children that we're supporting. How does that work?
Yeah, it's an issue that often is a bit of a hot button issue that it seems to be much ado about nothing because mm-hmm. you know, if you've ever done your own taxes, you know that claiming a child doesn't save you a whole heck of a lot of money. it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $800 to $1,200 ish. So oftentimes parties end up, divorcing spouses spend more money fighting over that than it's worth. It can obviously be valuable if you're going to claim, if you're contributing $5,000 to a flexible spending dependent care account.
Dependent care spending account, right?
Exactly. So that you can then, not include that $5,000 in your income, so you don't have to pay taxes on that.
Right.
But what happens more often than not is, under federal law, if the custodial parent, the quote-unquote custodial parent, gets to claim the child on his or her taxes.
Right.
But the property settlement agreement can change that. So often it is negotiated, and usually what happens is the parties simply end up alternating claiming the child. I claim the child this year, you claim the child next year.
Yeah, because you can't really split the dependency exemption, can you?
Correct. And that's, that's the most likely outcome if you went before a judge. They usually just simply alternate claiming the child.
Okay. Now, another big ticket item or seemingly big ticket item in divorce is the house. How do we claim mortgage deductions, taxes? What happens when we sell it? How does that work?
Right. And there's often, it's exacerbated by the fact there's often a lengthy period of time where, one spouse has moved out and the other spouse and oftentimes the children are still living in the house. And there's a lengthy period of time where the parties are negotiating, trying to get a property settlement agreement in place. So you could have, certainly more than a year where we're dealing with this issue. So it certainly is something that needs to be negotiated into the property settlement agreement.
And the marketplace dictates a lot about what happens with the house, too, because the market is not just such that you can just turn around and sell a house in 30 days, typically.
Exactly. So even if both parties are on board and really want to sell the house, you're absolutely right. It could take a significant period of time. So what often happens is you have the parties reach some kind of agreement as to when the house will be sold and who will pay the mortgage, during that time. And the easiest example is when the parties agree that they'll each pay the mortgage 50-50, in which case then usually what happens is each party gets to claim 50% of the mortgage interest deductions and 50% of the real estate deductions on his or her taxes.
Okay.
Sometimes you have the situation where it's just one party paying the mortgage.
Right.
And usually what's agreed is that person then gets to claim all of those deductions on his or her taxes.
Now, let's say one of the spouses remains in the house. Is that considered some kind of imputed rent, or because they're still married, it's not considered that? Or even if there's a divorce order or divorce decree that allows one of the spouses to remain in the house, is that taxable to the one who's remaining in the house?
No. Are you asking is
the use of the house? The use of the house.
No, the way it normally happens is it's not quite a tax issue. It's more of a property issue. And
right.
The spouse who's been living in the house, if they're paying the mortgage, then they're asking for usually more alimony, or they're asking the other spouse to contribute to the mortgage.
Right.
And if let's assume the person living in the house is the one paying the mortgage, when the parties end up dividing the property, the party who's been living there and paying the mortgage wants credit for the principal that they've paid down on the mortgage during the process. So that's
Absolutely.
Usually where it shakes out.
That's another good twist of the facts. Now, there's also the unusual circumstance where you actually sell the house. You get an exclusion for $250,000 if you're married filing jointly. If you're separate, you only get $250,000. You get $500 if you're married filing jointly. You only get $250 if you're single or married filing separately.
Correct.
So there are some rules on that. Can you allocate that? How that's going to be handled in the property settlement agreement?
You can. I mean, at least in the Northern Virginia real estate market, we haven't had to worry about that too much in the last 5 years because very few folks have. More than $250,000 of equity in their house or more than $250,000 of gain, certainly.
Good point.
So oftentimes we will include language in the PSA which governs that issue. It says if there's capital gains that each party, claims 50% or each party gets, X percent of the exclusion, but 99 out of 100 times it's a provision that doesn't do much because there are no capital gains, at least in this real estate market. Now, hopefully that will change at some point in the near future. But the general rule is, and there's a few parts of this rule, but the general rule is that, as you mentioned, a single person can exclude $250,000 of capital gain, and a married couple can exclude $500,000, as long as, to be able to qualify for the exclusion, the home needs to have been your principal place of residence for at least two of the last 5 years.
Are legal fees deductible?
legal fees can be deductible. It's a question that I don't get asked very often. I usually only get asked that when the party has a CPA or a tax attorney that they're working with. And it's really only the fees that relate to the collection of spousal support.
Right.
So oftentimes clients ask me to send me their bill with the line entries, you know, the line items showing spousal support. And oftentimes that's difficult to do because, you know, so many things are interrelated. So it's hard to parse out on an attorney's bill which line items are for alimony, which are for a bunch of different things.
Right.
You know, so it can be difficult. Usually we turn that over to the CPAs and let them deal with it.
We're talking with Dave Zangrilli. Dave, if people want to get in touch with you to talk about family law issues, how do they reach you?
They can either call me directly at 703-218-2152 or shoot me an email at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com.
Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me, Wayne.
Thanks for listening, and join us next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.